You're listening to Split Reel, the Chicago Independent Radio Project show on popular culture and societal attitudes. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and I'll be examining how film, television, and other elements of mass media both shape and reflect how we think about the world. For more information or for archived shows, visit splitreelradio.net. Welcome to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show, I'm happy to be joined by Maurice Berger, who, in addition to being a research professor at the Center for Art, Design, and Visual Culture at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and a senior fellow at the Vera List Center for Art and Politics, is also the author and curator of a new book and accompanying exhibit titled For All the World to See: Visual Culture and the Struggle for Civil Rights, which explores the historic role played by visual images in shaping, influencing, and transforming the fight for civil rights in the United States. Welcome to the show, Maurice.
Happy to be here.
So, Maurice, if you could tell me a little bit about the background in terms of the inspiration behind the book and the project, how that came about, what led to this research path for you?
I'm actually trained as an art historian and a cultural historian. My PhD is in American art history of the 20th century, but I also, really from my entire life, have been fascinated by the subject of American race relations. I didn't grow up the way most art historians grow up. I think most art historians come from, families are often middle or upper middle class or wealthy, and the field is a very glamorous one in a way. I grew up in a low-income housing project on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. My sister and I were among the few white kids in the whole project. I went to inner-city schools, and pretty much until I got to high school, really didn't attend schools with white people, and I am white. My mother is a Sephardic Jew. My father is an Ashkenazic Jew. Really didn't have white friends until almost college, and began to understand that my own race had meaning. I think that's one of the things that white people sometimes forget, is that we're a race too. There's so much time spent analyzing other races that we forget that indeed our race has meaning and indeed a tremendous amount of power. So as I grew up and had African American and Hispanic friends and we talked about these issues, I began to understand that I was treated differently from my friends. And this really started me thinking about the power of a simple skin color to grant someone immunity from the kinds of suspicion and anxieties that followed my friends in their lives. So when you put the two together, the interest in American race relations and the interest in visual culture, For All the World to See seemed like a natural outgrowth of this 30 years or so of research. The other thing about For All the World to See is that it also plays on imagery that is not normally discussed by art historians, television, film, magazines, newspapers, toys, other types of household objects. And that yet represents a third interest of mine, which is popular culture. So these issues came together to answer a question that had in fact never really been comprehensively dealt with before. The question of how visual images were used in the struggle for civil rights, not how they documented the struggle, which is the subject of virtually every civil rights exhibition and almost always about photography, but how images, aside from being documentary tools, were also tools of persuasion, inspiration, and motivation. And in that sense, this book and exhibition really are a first for examining the visual culture of the civil rights era.
And prior to the civil rights era, I think what the book and the exhibit do very effectively is they document how television, how radio, how print media have also led to the reinforcement of negative stereotypes. From you have Birth of a Nation to Song of the South and all sorts of incredibly racist print ads that helped contribute to the sense of the black underclass in America. I'd like to open with a line from your book. If the popular culture continued to offer a partial, fragmentary, or distorted view of black life, it was the goal of alternative representations to represent the full complexity and humanity of a people. to make visible, to paraphrase Ralph Ellison, that which had remained most invisible in the culture at large. And one of the things that you do in the book is you talk about how television and film really struggled to portray or depict a very complete image of Black life. How do you feel about the depiction of the African-American community in 2010? Here we are about 50 years beyond the Civil Rights era.
Well, I think that one of the important issues that is central to the book and to the exhibition is the idea that there's a kind of tension between localized African-American communities and a people taking into its own hands the job of representing itself, and a vast national mainstream media that serves an audience well beyond the African-American community. What you start to see is that there's this incredibly brilliant, sometimes subtle and sometimes not so subtle dialogue, almost a battle, a struggle between the production of mainstream imagery of Black folks that sort of feeds white people's preconceptions, comforts them in some way, and often these images are negative or subservient, and an African-American community fighting against these types of imageries by producing an image of African-American life that is as complex, let us say, as most representations of white life are in the mainstream media. When I say that, I don't mean that each individual representation of a white family, for example, is necessarily not stereotypical or necessarily complex. But in the mainstream, there are so many possibilities for white people's self-representation that the range of whiteness and its meanings tend to come across. But in the mainstream media with regard to African Americans, there are very few projects, even to this day, that are green-lighted within the mainstream. So that every single morsel of Black representation becomes this incredibly powerful symbol or icon of meaning around Black people. And there is where the problem lies, and it's where it lay back in the 1950s and 60s and where it continues to remain a problem. I think, for example, of the recent controversy over the film Precious. In and of itself, you could argue, well, Precious shows some aspect of an African-American life and isolates it and explores it. The problem with that statement is that there are so few movies about African-American life that make it into those broad mainstream contexts, and even fewer that get nominated for Oscars. After all, Spike Lee doesn't get nominated for Oscars, and his films are far more complex and humanistic than Precious. But the problem is that Precious then becomes this sort of icon of the moment. It's the flavor of the moment, which very often happens to people of color. Suddenly, one film is out there, and that represents everything. So, for example, there's this notion that I've read in a number of white critics' readings of Precious, that the film offers a kind of authentic view of Black life. And I ask the question, how is it authentic? Is the story that Precious tells a story of violence, of parental abuse, of incest? Are these stories authentic to Black life? Do white families not experience the same kinds of things? I think that's a kind of ridiculous notion. Yet, there's one Precious. It gets nominated for Oscars. It gets all this critical acclaim, mostly from white critics. And what you're left with is this very regressive, negative view of African-American life that supposedly stands for the whole in an age when Barack Obama is president of the United States. So I think that the problem continues in the sense that, at least in the mainstream, there is very little incentive on the part of the studios or the TV production companies to produce stories of African-American life that are as complex and humanistic and varied as what you see in the cultural mainstream for white people, where you have a kind of normative status where whiteness is unexamined, but that the full complexity of white life and the hundreds of thousands of things that have been greenlighted comes across.
With regards to Precious, you know, I think you could probably say the same thing about the inner city films like Boys in the Hood and Menace to Society that came out in the early 90s and that received a great deal of critical acclaim, but they were incredibly violent films and depicted this picture of young Black males especially as being incredibly dangerous and living in a sort of war zone. That even if these films were very well made, which I think that they were, and even if they were very socially important, that to white America, they were just going to kind of reinforce that stereotype of the African-American community as being a self-destructive, dangerous one.
The mainstream tends to reward that stereotype. There's a pattern. If you look at this sort of pattern of what gets, not only what gets greenlighted in Hollywood, but what gets praised, what gets critical reception, what gets other awards, there's this interesting pattern. These movies have what I would argue are reassuring stereotypes for even the most liberal white people who harbor fear and resentment of racial others. It reinforces stereotypes that are actually weirdly comforting. So a film like Boys in the Hood results in its director receiving the first Academy Award nomination given to a black director. And only one more time has that happened. This is now in recent years, the 90s and the earlier part of the 21st century. Only one more time that that happened. And what movie was it for the next round? Precious. And I think this is really interesting if you compare it to, for example, Spike Lee's films, which show such a complex range of African-American realities, from the magisterial Malcolm X to the extraordinarily nuanced and actually quite moving and beautiful semi-autobiographical view of black life that Spike produced in early 90s, I think it was 92, Crooklyn, which is a film that has moments of despair and moments of violence, but as it is about inner-city youth, as it is about a difficult time in his life in the early 70s. But having said that, it's also a film in which each of the characters is drawn out in a very complex, very beautiful way. In the end, the movie ends in this very optimistic way, in this strangely but beautifully humanistic way that doesn't seem to belong to these stereotypical films that stamp African-American life as automatically regressive or negative or violence-filled. And it's interesting because that's what gets rewarded in the mainstream. I think back to a TV show that most of your viewers probably will not remember, late 1970s, a TV show called Frank's Place. And I think Frank's Place was on CBS, and it aired predictably for only 22 episodes. It went off the air. What was Frank's Place? It was the story of this African-American professor who finds himself the proprietor of a restaurant in New Orleans. He's inherited this restaurant, and he decides to go down to New Orleans and make a go of it. And what distinguished Frank's Place was that it was not just a very nuanced view of black life in New Orleans, and it wasn't just its optimism and its sense of play and its lightness and its seriousness functioning simultaneously to produce a more realistic view of a life, but it was also a life that had running through it the realities of class problems and of racism. It was not just a depiction of black life that was happy-go-lucky, or it was a serious, honest depiction that included the triumphs, but also the daily agitation around race that existed for this character. The show couldn't survive. The question of why it couldn't survive, the answer to that question is a demographic one. It couldn't survive because white people wouldn't watch the show. And when you have a national television show, all the black folks in the world could watch the show. It still won't survive if white folks won't watch it as well. So the show couldn't build a national audience. And it was also beautifully done. It was beautifully acted. It was beautifully directed, very well written, but it couldn't survive. Just as in the early 60s, the program East Side, West Side, also CBS, produced a view of urban life that was nuanced and complex in so many ways, including powerful episodes about racism and class and poverty. That show also ran, I think, only for 22 episodes, coincidentally, and then it went off the air. So you do also have this reality of the expectations of a broader mainstream and a media that serves that mainstream and makes its income from that mainstream. And when you add that into the equation, it's very difficult for African-American projects that are more humanistic and complex to make it, unless they're part of a more localized black culture.
By the way, Frank's Place, I just looked up here, with Tim Reed, who played Venus Fletcher in WKRP in Cincinnati. Right around that time, of course, was the certainly the zenith of the popularity of The Cosby Show. The Cosby Show number one show in America for a number of years throughout the mid and late 80s, has received a fair bit of criticism in terms of, you know, perhaps has the show desensitized white America to issues of racism, because the Cosby Show is a sitcom that, for, you know, all intents and purposes, was colorblind, and certainly portraying a very affluent family. You know, Bill Cosby plays a doctor, his wife is an attorney, and there are images here and there of African-American culture interspersed in the show. The program doesn't deal at all with any issues revolving around race. It almost seems, in a sense, though, that it's kind of a, you know, no-win scenario for Black America, that, you know, if you have Precious or Boys in the Hood, that might reinforce the wrong kinds of stereotypes, and yet if you also have a show like The Cosby Show, then people are going to criticize the show for not addressing those sorts of issues. What are your feelings on the program?
Well, I think you point out, the question sort of isolates the real issue, which is the idea that somehow in the mid-'80s, The Cosby Show was the Black show. And in fact, it was the Black show. There were some African-American characters dispersed on other shows like St. Elsewhere, for example, where Denzel Washington got his start in television. But that show was the Black show. Now, if you think about how many shows were on primetime in the mid-'80s, you realize that it was a tiny, infinitesimal fraction of what was on television. So I guess what I'm really saying, Kevin, is that my problem with The Cosby Show is not so much The Cosby Show. I mean, it was charming, and it was positive, and it was upbeat, and it certainly offered all of America a view of African-American life that wasn't filled with violence and agitation and poverty. It also served to embolden the Black middle class, that suddenly middle-class Black folks, for one of the rare instances in the history of television, saw themselves represented on the screen. And yes, there was a certain degree to which the show didn't deal with Black culture, but my problem really isn't so much with The Cosby Show. It's the fact that it was the only game in town. You know, if The Cosby Show was then offset by another show, let's say, that dealt with Black musical idiom or some sort of African-American cultural idiom, if there was a show about an African-American artist and another situation comedy about an African-American group of friends in Baltimore or in New York, I mean, it's that it simply had to represent, which is true of African-American culture anyway, it represents in a mass cultural context that doesn't sanction many images of African Americans. So I may be a little bit more forgiving of that show than some of my colleagues. I just think that it just was being forced to represent a whole when any show could only represent realistically a fraction.
You're listening to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show I'm joined by Maurice Berger, who is a research professor at the Center for Art, Design, and Visual Culture at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's also the author and curator of a new book and accompanying exhibit titled For All the World to See, Visual Culture and the Struggle for Civil Rights, which explores the historic role played by visual images in shaping, influencing, and transforming the fight for civil rights in the United States. And talking a bit about The Cosby Show and its impact, or perhaps lack of impact, in terms of America's view on race. Cosby Show now, it's about 25 years old. And, you know, it's interesting that we haven't really seen a show either prior or since that has been a predominantly Black show that's topped the ratings, television ratings. Are you surprised by that?
No. I think while people of color grow up in American society knowing all about whiteness, because it's all around them, it's all around us, so many representations on television are of white families, white friendships, white marriages, white business situations. And even if there's this sort of, I would say, almost shallow attempt to represent integration, there's very little of the Black cultural experience that makes its way into mainstream television. And I just think that when you have that as a kind of baseline, you just can't expect a national audience to sustain programming which is fundamentally centered on African American life. I'm saying that as a very negative thing. I think that part of it is simply people want to see what they know. I think we live in a culture where people are increasingly of the belief that they can become famous, so anytime they can see aspects of themselves, it makes them happy. But I do think that racism plays a role in this, or at least one of the things that leads into white people's racist response, is the fact that there's very little desire to learn from or learn about the other. And I think that lack of desire is one of the biggest problems we face in this country around the issue of race. And very often the only way that black representation can be popular is either if it feeds certain kinds of fears or stereotypes on the part of white audiences, or if the culture, that if you have representations that in some sense are so watered down and their cultural specificity so shaved away that you could substitute any race of actors and get the same story. You know, I think there's a lot of ignorance in the United States about difference. I think that white folks know very little about black culture. I don't think the reverse is true, since white people and white issues tend to dominate what students are taught in school, for example, or what you see in the culture. So I think that black folks are walking around, and people of color in general, with a much more resolved understanding of what white people's life is like, because you're seeing it every day, everywhere. And I just think that that lack of interest, that lack of ambition on the part of white viewers will increasingly lead to problems when you're trying to put out programming that explores cultural lives that don't seem to be terribly familiar to the mainstream.
Well, there's one historic program that dealt a great deal with issues of race, which is All in the Family. And All in the Family being aired in the mid-70s with Carol O'Connor as Archie Bunker and America's most famous redneck at that particular time. And there's a section of your book which talks about the impact of All in the Family on the depiction of African-American culture. And also in the exhibit, the traveling exhibit, which is now located in the International Museum of Photography in New York City, is a great video clip that you have with Sammy Davis Jr. for whatever reason winds up at the Bunker household and speaking with Archie. And Archie kind of coming to grips with his racism, but still being very respectful of Sammy Davis Jr. as a celebrity. And of course, Sammy Davis Jr. puts him in his place very subtly. the show over and over made a point of having Archie kind of deal head on with his race issues. What was the reaction of minorities to Archie Bunker and to All in the Family? Were they watching the program?
I don't know specifically how detailed Nielsen demographics were back then. I don't know if we have numbers on that. I was around back then, so I can tell you that I was in high school and most of my friends were African American, and we all watched the show. I think that the show was important for a number of reasons, and I think that while there were some who argued, the New York Times, for example, when the show premiered, that Archie was the kind of ultimate lovable bigot. And, and Carol O'Connor was a very good actor, and the character had his humor and sometimes even his oddball charm. But I think what was important about that show, and something that came across in my discussions about it with my African-American friends, was that it did something that, as far as I remember and as far as I felt at the time, no other television show or even other popular film had done. And that is that it brought into open the idea that racism was not just a phenomenon of the Jim Crow South, of the redneck police chiefs like Bull Connor, for example, sigging dogs on protesters and beating people with clubs and throwing young kids to the ground with double jet water hoses. Racism meant in the United States in the 60s and 70s. All in the Family premiered in 1971. That's what it sort of meant. That's what the mainstream media tended to represent as the problem we lived with. The point that Norman Lear, the producer of All in the Family, and Archie Bunker, the main character, make, I think, over and over again in that show, is that there was this dirty secret in the so-called liberal North, or the liberal West, or the liberal Midwest, or the moderate, or the tolerant Midwest. And the dirty secret was that racism was all around us, even de facto segregation, but that nobody talked about it, and nobody brought these issues to bear on very complacent white people in the Northeast, for example, who felt that it wasn't their problem, that they didn't have to. They just looked at the South and said, aren't those terrible white people? Aren't they horrible? Aren't they evil? But never really looked at their own attitudes around race. And I think what Archie Bunker did was he held up a mirror to white urban America and said, this is you too. And I can't imagine that that could be anything but a good thing, considering that racism was always the issue that you swept under the table, or you dealt with in the most genteel way, as in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, a film that premiered in 1967 about an interracial marriage and the response of the two sets of parents. It was so genteel, it was so out of place, that by the time the film premiered, the Supreme Court had already overruled miscegenation laws in all 50 states in the United States. And at that point, the film's obsession with this notion of the illegality of interracial marriage wasn't even true anymore. All in the Family made the reality of urban racism dynamically clear in a way that I think mainstream culture had not. It makes me think of another issue, which is how rarely that still happens. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. I'm not saying that there aren't examples of it. I think there are some extraordinary examples of it recently. Todd Haynes' Far From Heaven, for example, which exposes the deeply ingrained racism of liberal, tolerant Connecticut in the 1950s, or Mad Men more recently, which does an extraordinary job of exposing the racism that lay just below the surface of New York professional elite.
Yeah, I've actually done a couple of programs on Mad Men where we've talked about that very fact. And the only black characters that you see, right, are the servants, the elevator operators, the waiters, for instance, with the exception of, I think, one Mad Men character, actually, because he has a black girlfriend, right? And,
yeah.
And taking the bus down to organize voters during the Civil Rights era. But I want to get back to something that you talked about a little bit earlier in terms of All in the Family, where you quoted the New York Times as calling Archie Bunker America's most lovable bigot. Do you feel that on some level, redneck America still looked to Archie as something of a hero, a person who validated their views, even if he was made to often feel foolish?
I'm not sure that it was just redneck America. I think that you might find a number of white liberals who, you know, it's interesting that the character of Archie Bunker was fashioned after, and I'm not sure I'm getting this right, it was either Norman Lear's father or his wife's father. And it was based on a British television show, I think it was called Till Death Do Us Part. I would argue that that character is not so much a redneck character as a fairly classic example of a kind of what we call in New York City an outer borough conservatism. Men like Archie didn't always vote Republican. They sometimes voted for moderate or conservative Democrats. They often were motivated by local issues rather than national ones. I think that Archie represented a strain of urban racism that was very common back then. And I'm not so sure it was just rednecks who looked at him. I'm sure there were plenty of liberals who either saw themselves in Archie or saw their fathers or their mothers in Archie or their brothers in Archie. So I think it's not as simple as the redneck contingent getting all excited that they're on television, they're being represented. I think that Archie represented a sensibility that was broader than anyone at that moment wanted to admit. And I think he made a lot of liberals uncomfortable. And I think that the excuse that he was a lovable bigot and that he was spouting all these stereotypical views of Jews or blacks or Hispanics or using racial epithets, that somehow that was so terrible and so offensive. You know, I don't think that was really all that offensive to people of color who knew that this reality existed and also understood and continue to understand the extent to which white people don't want anyone else to know that this reality exists. So, again, I think that on the whole, All in the Family and Archie were pretty important breakthroughs in American television and in at least beginning an honest conversation about racism in the so-called liberal North.
You're listening to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show I'm joined by Maurice Berger, who is a research professor at the Center for Art, Design, and Visual Culture at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's also the author of a new book and the curator of the accompanying exhibit titled For All the World to See, Visual Culture and the Struggle for Civil Rights. And we've just been talking a little bit about the landmark show All in the Family, and I asked you before a little bit about whether large numbers of African Americans also watch the show. And one of the things that I want to get to is the split in terms of viewing habits between black and white America. And I remember reading in the past about how While the show Seinfeld was number one in the 1990s, it ranked far down the list in terms of Nielsen ratings in black households. And actually, that was one of the criticisms of the show, of Seinfeld and also the show Friends, both set in New York City and both largely devoid of any kind of black characters. Have you done any research regarding splits in TV viewing by race? Is this something that's become perhaps more exacerbated as time has gone on?
Well, I think it's always been a problem. What I'd like to do is almost turn your question around, not look at it in terms of the present, but take it back to the early 50s, at the birth of television. In the early 50s, even though there was much more experimentation at that point, in some ways, this was one of the great periods of experimentation because the medium was young. And you did actually see an unusual number of African-American characters that were brought into TV shows in the 50s or on variety shows, for example, like the Nat King Cole show. So there was an African-American presence on television. Still, the mainstream was dominated when, indeed, African-American representation was part of the story. It was dominated by either very negative stereotypical characters like Amos and Andy or issues of servitude like the maid Beulah or the maid and the tailors, the first African-American character on American television in a show that premiered in 1948 on the DuMont Network. So you had this kind of like national view of blackness, and then you had all of these shows that were pretty much lily white, and then you had something else that starts in the 50s and really blossoms in the late 60s and early 70s, and that is the beginnings of what I would argue you could sort of call local black television, although sometimes the media markets were a little bit more than just local. Sometimes these shows were syndicated. But you had shows like Harlem Detective in 1954, for example, a local New York show, or Soul or Colored People's Time in the late 60s on public broadcasting that allowed black folks not only to represent themselves on television, but to produce, write, and direct their representations. And when you begin to look at that split, it's fair to say that those local black shows were sustained because they didn't have to appeal to a national audience. They were sustained by local black communities who were very enthusiastic and watched those shows in great numbers. Whereas these national shows, they survived based on whether white people were going to watch them. And alas, the shows that were able to survive were not shows like Frank's Place or shows like Harlem Detective, but were shows like Beulah and Amos and Andy and Good Times in the 1970s or some of the ghetto comedies. So you have these two separate realities, and those realities produce two sets of viewing audiences within the African-American community. The local black viewer, who loves this more nuanced, more realistic, more complex view of black life, and then the black viewer who is forced to watch national television because that's pretty much all there was on prime time. That suggests where the problem really lies. As long as black folks are not in the position to produce national television programming, and as long as these negative stereotypes ride through, and as long as shows which deal with quote-unquote mainstream circumstances, which are in turn invariably white, like Seinfeld or Friends, it's simply alienating a whole community of people who have little control over their representation.
Well, if I can interject here, I want to reference a recent interview that Spike Lee gave on BET, where he alluded to Tyler Perry programming as kind of taking America back perhaps to the days of Mantan Moreland. You know, here we are in 2010, and what he was saying is that there's BET, there's diversification in terms of media, there are other networks to air programs if they can't get, for instance, a national audience. But also you have Black America turning out for Tyler Perry films. And he mentioned that John Singleton made a movie called Rosewood, depicting a very different segment of African-American life, and no one showed up. I don't think that there's that same dominance in terms of control of the media, in terms of control of outlets as far as TV and film goes, that there was perhaps 50 years ago. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
If you look at who runs the production companies, who are the owners of the major networks, who are the people who run cable television, It reminds me of something Amary Baraka said back in the early 60s. He said, give me a television station and we won't need a revolution. The fact is that black folks don't own television stations, big ones for the most part, white folks do. In other words, there is still this incredible divide in the media in which, you know, for every Tyler Perry film that gets out there, there are hundreds of films that are greenlighted which have no relationship to the local black communities or to black communities in general. For every show that has a black theme to it or it has essential or crucial black characters, you'll still find many more shows that either have no black characters or token blackness on it. Or I just think that there's a real problem here, and I'm not sure that it's resolved. We have an African-American president, and yet if you look at the bulk of programming on American television, very little of it actually deals with black life.
You mentioned shows like Amos and Andy and Beulah. These are shows that that aired in the 1950s, and I think for any viewer today, if you get a chance to check out some of the clips, you can find some of them on YouTube, and it's incredibly jarring to see, especially because of the fact that with Amos and Andy, you have a TV show that's based off of a radio show where I didn't know this prior to visiting your exhibit, but the radio show consisted of two white guys actually playing black characters for years and years. And then and there was a film where they played the characters in blackface. And then when they did the TV show, the network said, okay, now we have to have black actors. And I saw a clip somewhere of the actors of the show saying that they actually had to listen to recordings of the white actors playing those same characters on radio. Another question I have for you, I guess, that, you know, if you look back in terms of all the negative depictions of African-Americans, and certainly in TV and shows like Amos and Andy, was there a lot of internal pressure against those actors to appear on those broadcasts? Whether you're talking about Amos and Andy, whether you're talking about Beulah or Song in the South, you know, internally within the African-American community, was there any sort of pressure on the actors themselves who appeared in those productions?
One of the interesting things about For All the World to See is that when you examine the civil rights movement with regard to the usual parameters, which are protests and the great speeches and the boycotts, you see that the movement generally has a beginning and an end roughly early 50s through the late 60s. But indeed, if you examine the movement through the issue of visual culture, you realize that the origins of it are earlier. Starting as early as Birth of a Nation in 1915 and the NAACP protest against the film, but then begin really sort of blossoming in the late 40s, you start to see a real activism in the African-American community against these types of programs. There is a concerted effort, in fact, to examine the stereotypes of Beulah or to literally blast the grotesque stereotypes of Amos and Andy in black periodicals as well as African-American civil rights organizations. So there was a tremendous amount of pressure brought to bear, not so much on the actors who had little options anyway in terms of work and television, but really on the producers, on the networks, to really begin to examine whether they wanted to continue to go down this path of derogatory programming. It was a kind of teaching, an edification, a desire to work with the studios, and in fact the NAACP reached out to the studios, to try to figure out if there was a way to alter this habitually negative view of African-American life in the media. In a sense, that battle succeeded, in a certain sense, as you began to see increasingly more positive African-American characters on television in the 1960s and in the 1970s, and characters that also lived lives that were somewhat more complex and varied. So in a certain sense, the origins of those protests in the early 50s and certainly in the late 40s with Song of the South, for example, that agitation led to certain changes. Now, did it lead to a dramatic change? Did it lead to a effluence of positive black characters and black performers on American television? Not exactly, but it was one of the successful aspects of protest within the civil rights period.
You're listening to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today I'm joined by Maurice Berger, who is a research professor at the Center for Art, Design, and Visual Culture at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's also the author of a new book, For All the World to See, Visual Culture and the Struggle for Civil Rights, which explores the historic role played by visual images in shaping, influencing, and transforming the fight for civil rights in the United States. And one of the sections of the book deals with the relationship between African Americans and the news. And you listed a number of watershed moments in the book that deal with powerful imagery within the civil rights struggle, from the photos of the horrifically beaten Emmett Till to TV coverage of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. So I just wanted to talk about, I guess, a number of landmark race-based social and political events that have taken place since the civil rights era. The ones that come to mind over the last 20 or 30 years or so, you've got the Rodney King beating, for instance, and the acquittal of the officers involved in the subsequent riots, the O.J. Simpson case, obviously race playing a great deal in that particular event. Also, Farrakhan's Million Man March occurring at the right around the same time in the mid-90s. And there have also been a number of political commercials preying on racism and viewers. And one of the big ones that comes to mind is Lee Atwater's Willie Horton campaign commercial against Michael Dukakis, where Willie Horton was a man who was furloughed while Dukakis was governor. And I believe he raped a woman and murdered her as well, too. And that certainly had a great impact on that particular election. Any thoughts on any of these kind of pivotal moments regarding race in the news in the last 20 years?
Well, I think one of the things about that list of events is just how visual the response actually was, how much images mattered. In the opening of the book, as well as the opening of the exhibition, there's a clip from a TV show from 1968, a TV documentary produced by CBS News. It was called The Weapons of Gordon Parks. Gordon Parks was a brilliant African-American photographer and filmmaker and author. In the course of the documentary, building on his biography, A Choice of Weapons, Parks talks about the camera, and he says, you know, in my life, I experienced all manner of racism, and I could have picked up any number of weapons to fight against my enemies, my racist enemies. He said, but in the end, what I realized was that there was nothing more powerful than the camera to fight racism. And the opening of the show, for example, the clip from that documentary is, in fact, Parks engaging in what was for him the most powerful political act possible. He's sitting in his windowsill, he's loading his camera with film, and he's aiming it out the window and he's taking a picture. I think the story of race is so much about the visual, the color of skin, which is literally the baseline, black and white. We talk about race in very visual terms. And I think that in each of these cases, you see not just honest reporting, but you also see manipulative imagery. The darkening of O.J. Simpson's face on the cover of, I forget which of the two, national news magazines, for example, to make him look more ominous. But I think nowhere in the list that you offer is there more dramatic sense of the power of images as in the Willie Horton commercial. Atwater's commercial was short. It was, I think, under a minute. And yet it used this imposing image and this underlying narrative of this threatening black man who was released on furlough by the liberal governor of Massachusetts and went on to do terrible things, that definitely was very much part and parcel of the Republican effort since the 1960s to use race and to use the imagery of race to manipulate people's fears and anxieties around race and then to get an electoral result. So I think that Horton commercial, that potent one-minute commercial, which really led to a dramatic collapse of Dukakis' campaign, actually, in 1988, is a very good example of how images of race have, for so many, indeed, in the United States for two centuries, how those images have been very powerful tools of persuasion, of manipulation, but also, conversely, edification, and in terms of, for example, African-American images on American television, also ways of displaying to a people or demonstrating to a people that they belong. So the images are not only disposed in negative ways, but also often in very positive ways as well, which was getting back to what we were talking about before, the point of the campaign against negative imagery on the part of civil rights organizations, for example, in the early 50s, against programs like Beulah and Amos and Andy.
One of the other political advertisements I wanted to mention as well was from an operative named Alex Calistanos, and he came up with the famous hands ad for Jesse Helms in 1990, and Jesse Helms at that time running for re-election as the senator of North Carolina, and notoriously someone who was not all that enlightened regarding race issues, but the ad dealt with a pair of white hands that opened up an envelope that contained a job rejection letter. And the voiceover talked about how you needed that job, but because of affirmative action, it had to go to a minority. And the white hands crumple up the paper. It's about 30 seconds long. Incredibly racist and blatant at that, but was seen to be a very effective ad regarding North Carolina at that particular point in time. And Helms went on to win.
One of the main points for all the world to see is that images themselves were often powerful enough to change the world. Those photographs of the mutilated body of Emmett Till, for example, were almost single-handedly responsible for the rise of what sociologists have called the Till generation. That is, a generation of young African-American men and women who joined the movement based on the outrage they felt looking at that image. The photographs and certainly the moving images of the conflagration in Birmingham in 1968, one of the first moments in the country where white Americans fully began to acknowledge that there was a problem. All along the way in the struggle for civil rights, images like this played a role, for better or for worse. I think that there is an idea out there that the media is at once liberal and extremely gifted at using images to influence people. And I think that one of the things that we forget is just how skillful the right has been in using media images as well. And I think one of the things that Lee Atwater's Horton commercial and the Hands commercial for Jesse Helms tell us is that images are somehow hostage to their context, that an image alone doesn't carry the full range of meaning most often. It needs a caption, if you will. It needs a narrative. And indeed, the same image could project entirely different meaning with a different caption or a different context. I think of photographs of Martin Luther King sitting at a local meeting somewhere in the South, as a photograph was taken in the 50s, of King, and was used both by left and right-wing media sources. The left simply is an example of King as a community activist, and what the right did was they put an arrow toward King's head and wrote, "Communist meeting." So somehow two words completely recontextualized the meaning of that image. And I think that the right, they were often just as adept at image-making as the left. But one of the big lessons of For All the World to See was how particularly brilliant the American civil rights movement was in harnessing the power of visual culture. It was the first American political movement to truly take advantage of a full range of visual images to make its case to the American people, but also to use images to bolster the morale and the sense of purpose for what was often a demoralized African-American community. There was this extraordinary understanding that images mattered. But I think in all of these instances that you mention, whether coming from the right or the left, the story of American race relations has often been told through images that have had extraordinarily powerful effects on the psyche and consciousness of Americans, black and white.
By the way, just a couple of notes. I talked a little bit about Lee Atwater, and there's a great documentary that came out in the last year or so called Boogeyman. It's the story of Lee Atwater's life, and it's a pretty fascinating look at the man, especially because he was a huge fan of blues music, and there were quotes that he was a black man trapped in a white man's body, that he loved to play guitar with other black musicians, and at the same time contributed a great deal to race-baiting and political imagery that came out in the 80s. So a very interesting look at Lee Atwater. But we just have a few moments left, Maurice, and I want to ask you about this Spike Lee film called Bamboozled, about a modern-day televised minstrel show came out about 10 years ago with Michael Rapaport, who is an executive who is under pressure from a network to come up with a black-themed show. He's basically recreating a Mantan Moreland kind of show with black actors appearing in blackface. And what are your thoughts on the film?
It's one of my favorite films, actually. If I may use this hackneyed term, it is a masterpiece. It is. I would suggest your listeners, whether they have Netflix or they go to the neighborhood DVD store, and take it out, because it's a really important film. Why I think it is really important is not just because it takes a very bold and honest view of the inherent racism that imposes itself on the image of blackness in mainstream culture, but I think the other aspect of the film, which is really amazing, is that it really is arguing that it's all a matter of degree, that the problem is not solved, that the issue is not over. And again, I think one of the motifs of our discussion, the idea of comforting stereotypes, is at the core of this movie. The idea that even now, certain types of comforting stereotypes exemplified by a film like Precious, or some of what Tyler Perry does, that those stereotypes are paradoxically appealing to white people, but also in some ways appealing to black people. I think there's also an underlying critique in the film around the negative culture that's being produced by certain black filmmakers or black writers. But there's just something so profound about the movie's understanding that this problem is here, not perhaps to stay, but it's here, it's going to be here for a long time, unless some very basic understandings of what the mainstream sanctions and what the mainstream accepts, and also what black people are willing to tolerate, changes. So it's a really great film. There's also this extraordinary, at the end of the film, there's this montage of blackface in American film, and I also think television. I have a feeling that it's not just all, it may be all film clips, but it's this breathless, probably 3-minute montage of all kinds of examples of Sambo imagery and Piccaninny imagery and blackface imagery and mainstream film, and I just blows you away. It really corners you. It makes you ask a question. Who would find this imagery desirable? What kind of a mind would look at this and think it was funny even? I mean, it's so brutal. It's so sharp. It's so breathtaking. And this is essentially a 3.5-minute history of a important aspect of American filmmaking and American mass media. It's a really incredible film. I would very much suggest your viewers take a look at it.
You know, I was back on the East Coast recently visiting family, and I'm Irish-Colombian. I just found out on the Irish side of my family that my grandfather, who died before I was born, actually used to dress up in blackface and participate in kind of a barbershop quartet back in the, I guess, early half of the 20th century. And I was just shocked by that. You've been listening to Split Reel on the Chicago Independent Radio Project, and my name is Kevin Fulham, and I've been joined today by Maurice Berger, who is a research professor at the Center for Art, Design, and Visual Culture at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's also a senior fellow at the Verilis Center for Art and Politics, and he is the author and curator of a new book and accompanying exhibit titled For All the World to See: Visual Culture and the Struggle for Civil Rights. And Maurice, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you. And look forward to listening to Split Reel.
For Maurice Berger, my name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Split Reel on the Chicago Independent Radio Project. And for more information or to listen to archived shows, visit splitreelradio.net. That's splitreelradio.net.